May it please the court. Tom Carberry appearing for Mr. Bassford. In my opening brief, I put the fifth issue fifth, mainly because it wasn't objected to and it's a plain error issue, but I think it's a very important public policy issue, so I'd like to address it a little bit here. It deals with private placements of securities to accredited investors. Now, these are two distinct areas of the securities law that were not addressed by the trial court. Private placements are dealt with separately by federal securities law, and so are accredited investors. They have different standards, and I believe the trial court was wrong not to instruct on scienter or mens rea, and also to not instruct on materiality and how the accredited investor affects this materiality concept, because accredited investors are by definition basically rich people. People that have assets, people that can afford to lose their money, people that know how to deal with the stock market. The disclosure rules are different for accredited investors.
Isn't this case under the state security statute? So shouldn't we be looking at those rules and the statute and the cases? Not what does Regulation D have to do with materiality in a state securities fraud case?
Well, that's the issue, Judge Lowe. That's the real issue here. Colorado, in general, just follows the federal securities law.
But Regulation D has to do with whether it should be registered or not. It doesn't have anything to do with whether there's securities fraud.
But it has definitions of accredited investors, and also it has rules on private placements, and those should have been given to the jury, because those are facts that people have a right to know. Also, when you're talking about materiality, the way the prosecution presented materiality didn't make sense to the jurors. For instance, the prosecution argued they didn't disclose bankruptcy, his prior bankruptcy. But except for that wasn't true. He had disclosed it to a number of the investors, and second, it was publicly involved information.
Well, let me indulge me for a minute, and let me talk about this materiality issue, because one of your claims, and this fifth claim, is that the prosecution didn't put on sufficient evidence to prove materiality as to three or four or five different things that you talk about, one of which is bankruptcy.
Yes.
The case was filed under the Colorado Securities Act. There are, by my count, three subsections of 1151501, which are potentially relevant here, A, B, or C, and he was charged under all three sections, A, B, and C. B is the section that has to do with materiality, because you have a misrepresentation. So he's charged under all three sections. The jury instructions instruct with language that have to do with B and C, and the minimalist says he was convicted under A. I'm totally confused. But what's your issue? If your issue is on appeal is that they didn't prove materiality, that's subsection B. And it can't be A or C, because materiality has nothing to do with A or C. So what are we being asked to consider here? The charging document doesn't match with the jury instructions, and the jury instructions doesn't match with the minimus.
Then that's
well, but that's not an argument you're making on appeal, so I don't even know what I'm looking at here.
No, I understand, Judge Loeb, and it's because of the way the case came up, and nothing was actually preserved, or few things were preserved, except for the issues that I had. I wrote it up this way. Also, one of the problems is that I'm a criminal defense lawyer, and my knowledge of securities law isn't that great. I have to make that admission. I've done dozens and dozens of appeals, and almost all of them are in criminal cases, and this is an unusual thing where we have this. But I still think the materiality calculus, no matter how you look at it, what was failed to be disclosed here could not have been material.
Why do you even need materiality if he's being charged under C or A, and materiality is not relevant to those sections?
All right. Then I did not see that, but then the instruction was irrelevant in the whole.
It talks about B and C.
Okay. Well, then let me proceed then.
Well, in addition to that, are you saying that it's all right to misrepresent to an accredited investor? Just because they're accredited investor, then the promoter can say almost anything he wants? But
nothing was misrepresented, Judge Roy. The indictment itself says that he revealed the bankruptcy to a variety of the investors. All the investors knew about Gotta Jobs. It was on the front page of the Denver business section. All right, of the Denver Post business section. All the investors knew about the fact that he had failed businesses before. Mr. Bassett was an older man. All these people have known each other for a while. And I don't think there's no evidence that he didn't disclose. There are differences. Some people said he made like $20 million on Gotta Job, and other people said he made like 10. But the reality of it is he did invest his money from Gotta Jobs into this Autobox program. I mean, he's the biggest investor in Autobox. So I don't see where he lied to anybody here in this case. The biggest problem here is we had a really skilled prosecutor trial lawyer and a very unskilled defense trial lawyer. That's really what this case is about.
Mr. Carberry, you have a contention on appeal that there were no misrepresentations proved, and that's what you just talked about, but I thought you started talking about what the instruction should have said. So I want to get back to that issue. I didn't see anywhere in your brief what you say the instructions actually should have said about accredited investors. What should it have said?
I think they could have just quoted the actual statutory language for what an accredited investor is.
How in the world does that help the jury decide the case?
Well, because if you take what the securities law says, an accredited investor, I can't remember what the total income is, $300,000 on assets of certain level of millions of dollars, and then you take the securities law's disclosure requirements, what has to be disclosed to the accredited investor, that's also statutory, and put those two together, and then the jury has a clear idea of what these people should have been told.
Oh. This is plain error review on this particular yes. point. How was this supposed to have been obvious to the trial court? That's one of the requirements of plain error. We don't have any case saying anything about this. In fact, we have cases expressly approving the instruction given in this case. How was it supposed to be obvious to the trial court that it was supposed to include language that you can't even really specifically identify?
No, I agree, Judge. That is the biggest problem that we have here. Pendergrass obviously approved the standard jury instruction that we have. It is a problem. That's why I put the issue last. But I thought it was an issue that the court should address, because we have a gap in Colorado case law, because these type of offerings are very different than your normal securities public offering, Judge Jones. They're very different. This is a private placement to rich people in a small group, and some of these rich people are actually investors at a different level, like the car dealers not only invested and bought stock, but they also were on the other end of the program. They were the people that had to make the $50 payments and other things like that.
I understand that you know, certainly counsel is free to argue that because these are sophisticated people, what may be material to them is not material to somebody else and vice versa. They're free to argue that, but I guess what I'm having trouble with is where the legal authority is for imposing a different standard of materiality as a matter of law under a state statute, which makes no such distinctions.
And Mr. Carberry, before you answer, because Judge Jones's question is right on the money, I just want to expand it a bit. The rule in Prendergast comes directly from federal authority. It comes from the definition of materiality in the Basic versus Levinson case. And I don't know of any federal securities case that says when you have an issue of sophisticated investors, you use something that other than the regular definition of materiality. So now with both of those, what's your authority?
There is authority. I said in the brief, there's federal cases that say that under 10B and 10B5, that the elements include scienter and include materiality and scienter. And
but the judge instructed on materiality and scienter. Sure he did.
Willfulness. Instruct on willfulness. Violation had to be willful and define willfulness.
All right. I see I'm almost out of my time. I would like to basically address a couple of other issues. The first issue it had to be theft from the corporation. They charged the man 2 years after the stocks were sold. People reinvested. We would have a complete, it would be very difficult to sell stocks anymore if you could, a couple years down the road, you could be charged with theft for somebody, theft from the investors when you stole from the corporation, because that's what they're saying, is he took money from the corporation's account. As to the second issue, Guaranty Bank lost nothing. One of the key things in fraud is you have to defeat the security. Guaranty Bank walked away with the money. Land Title lost the $17,000. Guaranty Bank walked away a winner. That's defrauding the secured creditor, and as the theft from Guaranty Banks is the same argument. They lost nothing, so they lost. They didn't get nothing got stolen from them, and they didn't. Nothing happened to their security interest in the car. They got all the money for the house, and they got all the money for the car. And Land Title lost the $17,000 and had to pay the Arapahoe County Court, not Guaranty Bank. And for that, I'd ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is John Seidel, representing the people, and my number is 17633. I'll try to address the issues kind of in the order that opposing counsel did. I think the court's questions are really good ones, and in some ways they point out the deficiencies or the problems with the opponent's argument. In the first place, I think it's right. I think Judges Loeb and Jones noticed that the court did instruct on scienter, and that the instruction given was essentially that approved by this court in Paul, People versus Paul, P-A-H-L. Now, one of the, I guess the chief argument that is made is that we need to, the part of materiality is accreditation of the investor. Now, our Supreme Court in 1985 said that materiality exists when there's a substantial likelihood that a reasonable investor would consider the matter important in making an investment decision. And I think the judges are correct that there's no federal or state case that I was able to find, and maybe the court hasn't either, that says that a reasonable investor is different from an accredited and is not different from an accredited investor. In other words, reasonable investors is a class of investors, and accredited investors falls within that class. And so they are entitled, accredited investors, just because they're rich, are should be protected from being lied to. And I believe Judge Roy asked that question, and our answer is definitively not. It's not okay to lie to accredited investors. Now, before I go further with that discussion, I think it's important, and I'm glad that Judge Loeb pointed this out, that one of the theories of the securities fraud charge was subsection C of the relevant statute, and that was alleged, and the jury was instructed that it was illegal to, in quote, engage in any act, practice, or course of business which operates or would operate as a fraud or deceit upon any person, all of that in connection with the sale of a security. And in that part of the statute, materiality doesn't matter. The materiality of representations or omissions doesn't matter.
And I agree with you, counsel. What do you do with the fact that the minimus says he was found guilty under subsection A, which, by the way, I don't think materiality is relevant to that subsection either, but I mean, I'm trying to come to grips with what the defendant was convicted of here.
Well, I think that...
Is it just a mistake in the minimus?
That would be my guess, because I don't believe subsection A was ever argued that theory was never presented to the jury and was never argued that way. If you look at the closing argument, a lot of it was about how Mr. Bastard, you know, was making deceitful statements or omitting to tell certain facts to the investors before he took their investments.
And A isn't in the jury instructions either. B and C are.
I didn't even look at the minimus, to be honest with you, and so I didn't see that A was on there. But my guess is, I guess my position would be, since B and C were charged and they were in the instructions, then he had to be convicted of one of those two ways of committing the crime. And now A is in the minimus. On the one hand, I'm tempted to say, look, the crime is only under 501, and there's alternative ways of committing it. And so what appears on the minimus in terms of alternatives isn't really, it's not of legal significance. But if it is significant that A appears instead of B or C, my suggestion is that that's a typographical error and could be corrected without any prejudice to Mr. Bastard or the state.
Let me ask you a question. On the theft involving the home, sale of the home in Edwards, you seem to concur in your brief that that charge cannot stand. You then cited additional authority to us. My question to you is, does that additional authority, in your view, withdraw your concurrence that the theft count can't stand?
Let me see, back up a minute. I thought that what I had said in the brief was that the forgery count was a problem.
I'm sorry, you're right.
Okay,
forgery.
Okay.
So you're right.
If I recall, the forgery verdict form...
There are only about 60 charges here, so...
Now that was not my decision.
The forgery, you're right.
So it says forgery at one point, and then below it says we the jury, and then I think they say we find the defendant guilty of theft. So my position is theft is okay, at least insofar as that problem goes. Now, I looked at some more cases about verdict ambiguity. I think that if you go back in Colorado cases, there's a case called Kreiser versus People, 604 P. 2nd 27. It's from 1979, and it says...
I'm not asking for additional authority. I'm asking, are you still concurring that...
Again, I just wanted to get to that as to why.
Okay, 604 P. 2nd what?
P. 2nd 27. It says, basically, a verdict is not uncertain if it is phrased in words which convey beyond a reasonable doubt the meaning and intention of the jury. The supplemental case I cited you, basically it was a case where there was a lesser included that the jury was instructed on, but the verdict form for that offense was, and I don't recall the details, but it was deficient. And this court, a division of this court, said, well, that's not really prejudicial because the jury was instructed on the lesser included crime, and we don't have any reason to think they didn't deliberate on it. The fact that the verdict form was messed up, they didn't find for that offense.
I think they were given a verdict form.
Maybe that's what it was.
I think the problem, they weren't given a verdict form for a lesser included.
So I think this court said, well, they didn't find, there was no verdict form, but we don't have no reason to think that they didn't deliberate. And since the jury actually found for the greater offense, that error wasn't prejudicial. Well, I just don't think that that case salvages this one. This verdict form, you know, there's a case out of California which, if it's slightly different, and I could cite it to you, but frankly, I'm just not sure that it gets us where we need to be.
Sure. So now I'd like to ask you about the count relating to defrauding a secured creditor. The argument's been made, of course, that because the bank received $17,000 that it otherwise wouldn't have gotten, and it was able to, that loan or that lien was paid off, that it suffered no damage. Now, let's say hypothetically it hadn't received the $17,000. been no release of the lien. It would have retained collateral with a value of less than $17,000. So it seems to me the bank would have been worse off if they hadn't gotten the $17,000. They would have had some partially secured claim against the defendant, which they may or may not have ever been able to satisfy. And here instead, they're fully satisfied.
Let me see if I understand your question before I
sure.
answer it. You're saying that if they hadn't been paid, the defendant would have been convicted of other things, and they had the $17,000 loan against the car that wasn't worth that.
The bank was not supposed to get the $17,000, is my understanding.
It
was never supposed to get that money, but it got it. And it took that extra money and applied it toward the car loan and paid it off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the bank's loan is fully paid off. Whether it has a lien or not anymore seems to me to be rather immaterial. What does it care? Had the bank not received the $17,000, what it would have had was a lien on a vehicle that I think the only evidence was that it was sold for $7,500.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bank would have been underwater on the car. So it seems to me the bank is better off.
See, I disagree with that. First of all, it received funds, the $17,000, that it wasn't entitled to receive. It was not any money that was in excess of what the Edwards home mortgage was supposed to go to the Arapahoe County District Court.
That was a loss to the people who hold the attachment lien.
Well, that's true, but I'm getting it. So you've got the bank, it's holding the loan on this car. It gets paid the $17,000. And it releases the lien on the car. Now it has no security interest at all on the car. The car is sold. The bank gets none of that money. That money goes to the defendant. So the bank has $17,000 of the money that should have gone to the investors, and defendant has gotten out of his car lien. Plus he's got some $7,500 in cash. The problem is that the bank's now got this money that it wasn't supposed to have. It doesn't really, and in fact, and not only that, but they released the lien on the car. And the evidence, as I understand it, was that the bank actually paid Land Title $10,000 as a partial reimbursement for the money it had to pay to the Arapahoe County investors. And I forgot my notes today, but if the court wanted that, I could give you the site and the record for that. And furthermore, there's also evidence that the bank was possibly subject to a contempt proceeding because of what happened, even though they had obviously, I think they had a decent defense, namely that they got the money in one hand, didn't know what the other was doing. So the bottom line is, the defendant, by using money that wasn't his to spend, gave that money to the bank. The bank said, we release our lien, and now the bank is basically on the hook for that money, or there's going to be a big fight over that money. Maybe not a big fight, but there's going to be a fight over it. The bank's reputation is damaged to some degree, might be in contempt. It's already paid over some of it, and it doesn't have the car lien anymore. So in theory, the possibility exists that it's going to be out the $17,000 and possibly more with attorney's fees. It doesn't have the lien anymore.
But can we convict a defendant on these possibilities? I guess that's my point. I mean, we don't know what's going to happen with all that, you know, with that $17,000.
Well, I think that what we all that had to be proved was that the defendant knowingly sold, assigned, transferred, conveyed, or disposed of any collateral subject to a security interest. And here's the ticket. With intent to defraud a creditor by defeating, impairing, or rendering worthless or unenforceable any security interest. So it's not really what actually is going to happen or what has happened in the last few years since this trial, but what was the defendant's intent? And my suggestion is, well, when the defendant did all this, forged the document, and he sent it to the title company, they paid the money, and then he sold the car after the lien was released, that suffices to show intent to defraud the bank.
But what if the
didn't know the $17,000 is going to the bank, and so wouldn't his intent to be to have the loan paid off? How is that defrauding the bank? My intent, even though I know the bank's not entitled to this money, okay, and it's coming from somebody that shouldn't it shouldn't come from, but I want to pay this loan off. So I'm. How is that an intent to defraud the bank as opposed to somebody else?
Well, let me answer by turning the tables on the court a little bit and giving the hypothetical. Suppose the defendant went out and robbed a bank. The bank, the same bank, turned around and paid the bank the money for that loan. Not the same bank, that hypothetical's bad. Suppose he went out and robbed, I don't know, stole money from a person's retirement fund and used that money to pay off his car loan. Then he sold the car. Well, he's convicted of the theft from the elderly person. He's got to pay restitution. And it seems to me that there would be a legal fight over whether that bank was entitled to that money since it was stolen. It seems to me that anytime you're using money that you don't have access or that's not yours to pay off a loan and get somebody to release whatever security, the interest you have in your collateral, that's subject, if that's what you're doing, then a jury could find you intend to defraud that creditor.
Oh, to use your hypothetical though, you're assuming there's gonna be a fight between the defrauded person, or not the defrauded person, the elderly person in your hypothetical, and the bank. But as you said, the defendant is required to pay restitution to the elderly person. So if the defendant pays that restitution, then the elderly person has no recourse against the bank. I guess what we're talking about here are some kind of hypothetical harms to the bank when the only concrete harm is to, in your hypothetical, the elderly person.
Well, I disagree. I think the bank is, and I'll just answer this by saying that there is evidence in the record that G-Bank, Guarantee Bank, paid LTC some $10,000 as a partial payment on payment back of that $17,000. That's probably the quickest and shortest answer I can give you at this point. My time is up, and if there's no further questions, I thank the court for its time.
May it please the court. Just a couple of points. Judge Loeb, I did review the minimus. You're absolutely right. Well, while I was sitting there, and I'm not sure how to address your question on what he was convicted of. There aren't any interrogatories in the verdict forms, and the jury instructions don't actually distinguish, so I don't have an answer to your question.
Well, the jury instructions do use the language from B and C, so what do you think about Mr. Seidel's argument that that's what the case was tried on, that's what they were instructed on, and this is nothing more than clerical error?
And Rule 36 error. I don't know. I
understand.
I don't know the answer.
Perplexes me also.
And Judge Jones, I think you made the point that I was trying to make in my brief on the Guarantee Bank. The testimony doesn't say why they gave land title $10,000. We have no idea why that happened.
It happens to work out to be they kept what the car was approximately worth and gave back the rest.
Difference of $500. But there's no testimony to it, so we're basically just guessworking on it. And then I'd just like to reiterate that Autobux was operating for 2 years before these charges happened. And Mr. Bassford was taking money out of the Autobox corporate accounts to pay some personal expenses. That's got to be theft from the corporation, if it's anything. But, you know, as the accountants testified, the experts and accountants testified, the corporations had, the Autobox had enough money to pay for these withdrawals from Mr. Bassford. And there was nothing in any of the paperwork or any of the contracts that the investor signed that said he wasn't allowed to withdraw money from the corporate accounts to pay for these expenses. He did pay for his personal expenses out of the Autobox account, but how could that be a material fact to defraud, you know, to steal?
But he's doing it at the same time, isn't he? I mean, I'm coming to you, I'm asking you to invest money in my company at the same time,
no,
I'm drawing money out of the account.
No, that's not how it happens. You know, he gets the investment from people, he invests his own money, $1.5 million. He gets $300,000 from Doug Moreland, he gets $50,000 from Mr. Naughton, he gets a bunch of other investors that invest $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 or less. and the corporation starts going. He hires employees. He's got a CFO. They're doing all their things for a couple of years. And at some point, he starts taking money out of the corporation. But by then, the corporation is formed. And that's the Westfall case. The corporation is in existence. He took the corporation's money. It's not the investor's money. If I invest in Bank of America, that doesn't give me the right to go to their vaults and take their money.
Why isn't it the investor's money? Because didn't they invest based on his representation that their money was going to capitalize this corporation?
It's the corporation's money.
Well,
and they have stock in the corporation. What they own with their money, what they got was stock. And the corporation has its own accounts, and the corporation is an entity in its own, a being just like us, according to the U.S. Supreme Court. And they got, if there was any robbery, it was from the corporation and not from the investors. That's securities fraud. That's a different issue. That's not theft. Because, you know, the prosecution, when they were arguing this theft count, said, oh, we realized that he intended to deceive at the beginning. Well, that was a last-minute addition. That wasn't argued to the jury, you know, during the trial. And thank you very much. I see my time's up, and I ask the court to reverse.
Counsel, we thank both counsel for their briefs and argument. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.